one of my literature seminars. He was smart, talking of Pynchon and DeLillo in a way I never did, but he refused to speak a word about them outside of class. It drove her crazy, the lines he drew through his life, the walls he put up between work and play. In 20 minutes of conversation that night at Ivy, we both saw something we liked, a willingness to have no walls, or maybe just an unwillingness to keep them standing. It pleased Gil that he'd made such a good match. Before long, I found myself waiting for the weekends, hoping to run into her between classes, thinking of her before bed, in the shower, in the middle of tests. Within a month, we were dating. As the senior in our relationship, I imagined for a while that it was my job to apply the wisdom of my experience to everything we did. I made sure we kept to familiar places and friendly crowds, having learned from past girlfriends that familiarity always arrives in the wake of infatuation. Two people who think they're in love can find out, when left alone, exactly how little they know about each other. So I insisted on public places, weekends at eating clubs, weeknights at the student center, and agreed to meet at bedrooms and library nooks only when I thought I detected something more in Katie's voice, the come-hither registers I flattered myself I could hear. As usual, it was Katie who had to straighten me out. "Come on," she told me one night. "We're going to dinner together." "Whose club?" I asked. "A restaurant, your choice." We'd been together for less than 2 weeks. There were still too many parts of her I didn't know. A long dinner alone sounded risky. "Did you want to ask Karen or Trish to come along?" I asked. Her two roommates in Holder had been fail-safe company. Trish, in particular, who never seemed to eat, dependably talked through any meal. Katie's back was turned to me. "We could ask Gil to come, too," she said. "Sure." It struck me as an odd combination, but there was safety in numbers. "What about Charlie?" she asked. "He's always hungry." Finally, I realized she was being sarcastic. "What's the problem, Tom?" she said, turning back to me. "You're afraid other people will see us alone?" "No." "I bore you?" "Of course not." "Then what? You think we'll find out we don't know each other very well?" I hesitated. "Yes." Katie seemed amazed that I meant it. "What's my sister's name?" she said finally. "I don't know." "Am I religious?" "I'm not sure." "Do I steal money from the tip jar at the coffee shop when I'm short on change?"
"Probably."
Katie leaned in, smiling. "There. You survived." I'd never been with someone who was so confident about getting to know me. She never seemed to doubt the pieces would fit. "Now, let's go to dinner," she said, pulling me by the hand. We never looked back. 8 days after my dream about the satyr, Paul came to me with news.
"I was right," he said proudly. "Parts of the book are written in cipher."
"How'd you figure it out?"
"Cornuta. The word Jerome used to give Moses horns is the answer Francesco wanted. But most of the normal techniques for using a word as a cipher don't work in the hypnerotomachia. Look."
He showed me a sheet of paper he'd prepared with two lines of letters running parallel to each other.
"Here's a very basic cipher alphabet," he said. "The top row is what you call the plain text. The bottom row is the cipher text. Notice how the cipher text begins with our keyword, cornuta? After that, it's just a regular alphabet, with the letters from cornuta removed so they don't get duplicated."
"How does it work?" Paul picked up a pencil from his desk and began circling letters.
"Say you wanted to write hello using this cornuta cipher. You'd start with the plain text alphabet on top and find H, then look at its equivalent in the cipher text below. In this case, H corresponds to B. You'd do that with the rest of the letters, and hello becomes bugji."
"That's how Colonna used cornuta?"
No, by the 15th and 16th centuries, Italian courts had much more sophisticated systems. Alberti, who wrote the architecture treatise I showed you last week, also invented polyalphabetic cryptography. The cipher alphabet changes every few letters. It's much harder. I point to his sheet of paper. But Colonna couldn't have used anything like that. It just makes gibberish. The whole book would be full of words like bug-j. Paul's eyes lit up. Exactly. Complex encipherment methods don't produce readable text, but the Hypnerotomachia is different. Its ciphertext still reads like a book. So Colonna used the riddles instead of a cipher. He nodded. It's called steganography. Like writing a message in invisible ink, the idea is that nobody knows it's there. Francesco combined cryptography and steganography. He hid riddles inside a normal-sounding story where they wouldn't stand out. Then he used the riddles to create deciphering techniques to make it harder to understand his message. In this case, all you have to do is count the number of letters in Cornuta, which is 7, then string together every 7th letter in the text. It's not that different from using the first word of every chapter. Just a matter of knowing the right intervals. That worked? Every 7th letter in the book? Paul shook his head. Not the whole book, just a part. And no, it didn't work at first. I kept coming up with nonsense. The problem is figuring out where to start. If you choose every 7th letter beginning with the first one, you get a completely different result than if you choose every 7th letter beginning with the second one. That's where the riddle's answer plays a role again. He pulled another page from his pile, this one a photocopy of an original page from the Hypnerotomachia. Right here, in the middle of this chapter, is the word Cornuta, spelled out in the text of the book itself. If you begin with the C in Cornuta, and you write down every 7th letter for the next 3 chapters, that's how you find Francesco's plain text. The original was in Latin, but I translated it. He handed me another sheet. Look. Good reader, this past year has been the most trying I have endured. Separated from my family, I have had only the good of mankind to comfort me, and while traveling the waters I have seen how flawed that good can be. If it is true, what Pico said, that man is pregnant with all possibilities, that he is a great miracle, as Hermes Trismegistus claimed, then where is the proof? I am surrounded on one side by the greedy and the ignorant, who hope to profit by following me, and on the other side by the jealous and the falsely pious, who hope to profit by my destruction. But you, reader, are faithful to what I believe, or you could not have found what I have hidden here. You are not among those who destroy in God's name, for my text is their foe, and they are my enemy. I have traveled broadly in search of a vessel for my secret, a way to preserve it against time. A Roman by birth, I was raised in a city built for all ages. The walls and bridges of the emperors stand after 1,000 years, and the words of my ancient countrymen have multiplied, reprinted today by Aldus and his colleagues at their presses. Inspired by these creators of the old world, I have chosen the same vessels, a book and a great work of stones. Together, they house what I will give to you, reader, if you can understand my meaning. To learn what I wish to tell, you must know the world as we have known it, who studied it most of any men in our time. You must prove yourself a lover of wisdom and of man's potential, so that I will know you are no enemy. For there is an evil abroad, and even we, the princes of our day, do fear it. Carry on, then, reader. Strive wisely for my meaning. Poliphilo's journey grows harder, as does mine, but I have much more to tell. I turned the sheet over, looking for more. Where's the rest of it? That's it, he said. We have to solve more to get more.
I looked at the page, then up at him in amazement.
In the back of my mind, from a corner of unsettled thoughts, came a tapping noise, the sound my father always made when he was excited. His fingers would drum the rhythm of Corelli's Christmas Concerto twice as fast as any allegro movement on whatever surface he could find. "What are you going to do now?" I asked, trying to stay afloat in the present. But the thought occurred to me anyway, putting the discovery in perspective. Arcangelo Corelli finished his concerto in the early days of classical music, more than 100 years before Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Even in Corelli's day, though, Colonna's message had been awaiting its first reader for more than two centuries.
"The same thing you are," Paul said. "We're going to find Francesco's next riddle."
Chapter 13. Every hallway in Dodd is empty as Gil and I return to the room, numbed by the long walk north from the parking lot. An airy silence prevails throughout the building. Between the nude Olympics and the Easter festivities, every soul is accounted for. I turn on the television for word of what's happened. The local networks carry the nude Olympics on the late news, after there's been time to edit the footage, and the runners in Holder Courtyard float across the screen in a blur of whites, blinking under the glass like fireflies trapped in a jar. At last, the female news anchor returns to the screen. "We have breaking news on our top story." Gil emerges from his bedroom to listen. "Earlier tonight, we reported to you about what may be a related incident at Princeton University. At this hour, the accident at Dickinson Hall, which some witnesses describe as a fraternity stunt gone wrong, has taken a tragic turn. Officials at Princeton Medical Center confirm that the man, reportedly a university student, has died. In a prepared statement, Borough Police Chief Daniel Stout repeated that investigators would continue to examine the possibility that, quote, non-accidental factors had played a role. In the meantime, university administrators are asking students to remain in their rooms or to travel in groups if they need to be outside tonight." In the studio, the anchor turns to her co-host. "Clearly a difficult situation given what we saw earlier at Holder Hall." Returning to the camera, she adds, "We'll be coming back to this story later in the hour." "He died?" Gil repeats, unable to believe it. "But I thought Charlie..." He lets the thought trail off. "A university student," I say. Gil looks up at me after a long silence. "Don't think like that, Tom. Charlie would have called." Against the far wall, the framed picture I bought for Katie sits at an uncomfortable cant. I dial Taft's office just as Gil returns from his bedroom and hands me a bottle of wine. "What's this?" I ask. The phone at the Institute rings over and over, nothing. Gil steps toward the makeshift bar he keeps in the corner of the room, grabbing two wine glasses and a corkscrew. "I need to relax." There's still no answer at Taft's, so I reluctantly put down the receiver. I'm just about to tell Gil how sick I feel when I glance over and realize that he looks even worse. "What's wrong?" I ask. He tops the glasses off. Taking one in his hand, he raises it to me, then takes a sip. "Have some," he says. "It's good." "Sure," I say, wondering if he just wants someone to drink with, but the thought of wine is turning my stomach. He waits, so I nip at my share. The burgundy stings going down, but it has the opposite effect on Gil. The more he's got in him, the better he starts to look. I tip my glass back. Snow rolls across the pools of light from the post lanterns in the distance. Gil drains his second glass. "Take it easy, Chief," I say, trying to sound nice about it. "You don't want to have a hangover at the ball." "Yeah, right," he says. "I have to be at the caterer's tomorrow by 9. I should have told them I don't even go to class that early." It comes out sharp, and Gil seems to catch himself. Picking up the remote from the floor, he says, "Let's see if there's anything else on."
3 different networks are broadcasting from somewhere on campus, but when there doesn't seem to be any new information, Gil gets up and starts a movie. "Roman Holiday," he says, sitting back down. A distant ease comes over his face. Audrey Hepburn again. He puts down the wine. The longer the movie stays on, the more I find that Gil is right. No matter how heavy my thoughts are, sooner or later, I keep coming back to Audrey. I can't get my eyes off her. After a while, Gil's focus seems to cloud over a little. The wine, I guess. But when he rubs his forehead and focuses a second too long on his hands, I sense there's more to it. Maybe he's thinking of Anna, who broke up with him while I was at home. Thesis deadlines and planning the ball undid them, Charlie told me, but Gil never wanted to talk about it. Anna was a mystery to us from the beginning. He almost never brought her to the room, though at Ivy, I'd heard, they were never apart. She was the first of his girlfriends who couldn't recognize which one of us was picking up the phone, the first who sometimes forgot Paul's name, and she never stopped by the room if she knew Gil wasn't there. "You know who looks a little like Audrey Hepburn?" Gil asks suddenly, catching me off guard. "Who?" I say, dialing Taft's office again. He surprises me. "Katie. What made you think of that?" "I don't know. I was watching you two tonight. You're great together." He says it as if he's trying to remind himself of something dependable. I want to tell him that Katie and I have had our ups and downs, too, that he's not the only one who struggles in a relationship, but it would be the wrong thing to say. "She's your type, Tom," he goes on. "She's smart. I don't even understand what she's saying half the time." I hang up the phone when there's still no answer. "Where is he?" "He'll call." Gil takes a long breath, trying to ignore the possibilities. "How long's it been with Katie?" "Next Wednesday makes 4 months for us." Gil shakes his head. He's broken up 3 times since Katie and I met. "Do you ever wonder if she's the one?" It's the first time anyone has asked that question. "Sometimes. I wish we had more time. I worry about next year." "You should hear how she talks about you. It's like you've known each other since you were kids."
"What do you mean?"
"I found her at Ivy once, taping a basketball game for you on the TV upstairs. She said it was because you and your dad used to go to the Michigan-Ohio State game together." I hadn't even asked her to do it. Until we met, she'd never followed basketball.
"You're lucky," he says.
I nod my agreement. We talk a little more about Katie, then Gil slowly returns to Audrey. His expression lightens, but eventually I can see the old thoughts return. Paul. Anna. The ball. Before long, he reaches for the bottle. I'm just about to suggest that he's had enough to drink when a dragging sound comes from the hallway. The outside door opens, and Charlie stands in the sallow light of the hall. He looks bad. There are blood-colored stains on the cuffs of his clothes.
"You okay?" Gil asks, standing up.
"We've got to talk," Charlie says, with an edge to his voice. Gil mutes the television. Charlie goes to the refrigerator and pulls out a bottle of water. He drinks half of it, then pours some over his hands to wet his face. His focus is unsteady. Finally, he sits down and says, "The man who fell from Dickinson was Bill Stein."
"Jesus,"
Gil whispers. I feel myself go cold.
"I don't understand."
Charlie confirms it by the look on his face. "He was in his office in the history department. Someone came in and shot him."
"Who?"
"They don't know."
"What do you mean they don't know?"
A beat of silence passes. Charlie focuses on me. "What was that pager message about? What did Bill Stein want from Paul?"
"I told you, he wanted to give Paul a book he found. I can't believe this, Charlie."
"He didn't say anything else? Where he was going? Who he was going to see?"
I shake my head. Then, slowly, it returns to me what I'd mistaken for paranoia. The phone calls Bill had gotten, the books someone else was checking out. A wave of fear descends on me as I tell them.
Shit, Charlie grumbles.
He reaches for the phone.
What are you doing? Gil asks.
The police are going to want to talk to you, Charlie tells me.
Where's Paul?
Jesus, I don't know, but we've got to find him. I keep trying Taft's office at the Institute. There's no answer.
Charlie looks at us impatiently.
He'll be fine, Gil says, and I can hear the wine talking. Calm down.
I wasn't talking to you, Charlie snaps.
Maybe he's at Taft's house, I suggest, or Taft's office on campus.
The cops will find him when they need to, Gil says, face hardening.
We should stay out of this.
Charlie turns.
Two of us are already in this.
Gil scoffs.
Give me a break, Charlie. Since when are you in this?
Not me, you prick. Tom and Paul, there's more to us than just you.
Don't get sanctimonious on me. I'm sick of you butting into everyone else's problems.
Charlie leans forward, lifts the bottle from the table, and throws it in the trash.
You've had enough.
For a second, I'm afraid the wine is going to make Gil say something we'll all regret. But after glaring at Charlie, he rises from the couch.
Christ, he says. I'm going to bed.
I watch him retreat into the bedroom without another word. A second later, the light beneath the door falls dark. Minutes pass, and they feel like hours. I try the Institute again, but with no luck, so Charlie and I sit in the common room for the duration, neither one speaking. My mind is moving too quickly to make sense of my own thoughts. I stare out the window, and Stein's voice climbs back into my thoughts.
I get these phone calls. Pick up, click. Pick up, click.
Finally, Charlie rises. Finding a towel in the closet, he starts to put his bathroom caddy in order. Without a word, he heads out the door in his boxer shorts. The men's bathroom is down the hall, and there are half a dozen upper-class women living between it and our quad, but Charlie marches out anyway, towel wrapped around his neck like an oxbow, caddy in hand. Sitting back on the couch, I reach for today's Daily Princetonian. To distract myself, I flip through the pages, searching for a photo credit of Katie's somewhere in the nether corners of the paper, where underclass contributions go to die. I'm always curious about the pictures she takes, the new subjects she chooses, the ones she thinks are too unimportant to mention. After dating someone long enough, you start to imagine she sees everything the same way you do. Katie's photos are a corrective, a glimpse of the world through her eyes. Before long, a sound comes at the door, Charlie returning from the shower. But when a key strikes in the outside lock, I realize it's someone else. The door swings open, and it's Paul who enters the room. His face is pale, and his lips are blue from the cold.
Are you okay? I ask.
Charlie arrives back just in time.
Where have you been? He demands.
It takes us 15 minutes to get the details from Paul, given his state. After leaving the lecture, he went to the Institute and searched for Bill Stein in the computer lab there. An hour later, when Stein failed to appear, Paul decided to go back to the dorm. He started the trip in his car, only to have it quit at a stoplight about a mile from campus. Then he had to walk back in the snow. The rest of the night, he says, is a blur. He arrived at the north of campus to find police cars near Bill's office at Dickinson. After asking enough questions, he was driven to the medical center, where someone asked him to identify the body. Taft showed up at the hospital not long after, giving a second identification. But before he and Paul could speak, officers separated them for questioning. The police wanted to know about his relationship with Stein and Taft, about the last time he saw Bill, about where he was at the time of the murder. Paul cooperated in a daze. When they finally released him, they asked him not to leave campus and said they'd be in touch. Eventually, he made his way toward Dodd, but stayed on the outside steps for a while, just wanting to be alone. Finally,
We discuss the conversation we had with Stein in the rare books room, which Paul says the police took down in full. As he talks about Bill, about how agitated Stein was at the library, about the friend he's lost, Paul gives little sign of emotion. He still hasn't recovered from the shock.
"Tom," he says finally when we're back in our bedroom, "I need a favor."
"Of course," I say. "Name it."
"I need you to come with me."
I hesitate. "Where?"
"The art museum."
He's changing into a dry set of clothes.
"Now? Why?"
Paul rubs at his forehead, working out an ache.
"I'll explain on the way."
When we return to the common room, Charlie looks at us like we've lost our minds.
"At this hour?"
he says. "The museum's closed."
"I know what I'm doing,"
Paul says, already making for the hallway. Charlie gives me a heavy look, but says nothing as I follow Paul out the door. The art museum sits like an old Mediterranean palace across the courtyard from Dodd. From the front, where we entered a few hours earlier, it's just a stumpy modern building with a Picasso sculpture on the front lawn that looks like a glorified birdbath. When you approach from the side, though, the newer elements give way to older ones. Pretty windows in little Romanesque arches, and red roof tiles that peek out beneath tonight's canopy of snow. Under different circumstances, the view from here would be charming. Under different circumstances, it might be a picture Katie would take. "What are we doing?" I ask. Paul is trudging a path before me in his old workman's boots.
"I found what Richard thought was in the diary," he says.
It sounds like the middle of a thought whose beginning he's kept to himself.
"The blueprint?"
He shakes his head.
"I'll show you when we get inside."
I'm walking in his footsteps now to keep the snow out of my pant legs. My eyes keep returning to his boots. Paul worked at the museum loading docks our freshman summer, moving incoming and outgoing exhibits onto trucks. The boots were a necessity then, but tonight they leave dirty tracks in the moon white of the courtyard. He looks like a boy in men's shoes. We arrive at a door by the west face of the museum. Beside it is a tiny keypad. Paul dials in his docent's password and waits to see if it works. He used to give tours at the art museum, but finally had to take a job in the slide library because the docents weren't paid. To my surprise, the door opens with a beep and a whisper of a click. I'm so used to the medieval-sounding bolts of the dorm doors, I almost don't hear it. He leads me into a small antechamber, a security room supervised by a guard behind a plate-glass window, and suddenly I feel trapped. After signing a visitation form on a clipboard, though, and pressing our university IDs against the glass, we're cleared to enter the docent's library beyond the next door. "That's it," I say, expecting more of a shakedown at this hour. Paul points to a video camera on the wall, but says nothing. The docent's library is unimpressive. A few shelves of art history books donated by other guides to help prepare for tours. But Paul continues toward an elevator around the corner. A large sign posted on the sliding metal doors says, "Faculty, staff, and security only. Students and docents not permitted without escort." The words "students" and "docents" have both been underlined in red. Paul is looking somewhere else. He pulls a keyring from his pocket and plugs one of them into a slot on the wall. When he turns it to the right, the metal doors slide open.
"Where'd you get that?"
He leads me into the elevator, then presses a button.
"My job," he says.
The slide library gives him access to archival rooms in the museum. He's so careful about his work that he's earned almost everyone's trust.
"Where are we going?"
I say.
"Up to the image room, where Vincent keeps some of his slide carousels."
The elevator discharges us on the main floor of the museum. Paul guides me across it, ignoring the paintings he's pointed out to me a dozen times before. The vast Rubens with its dark-browed Jupiter, the unfinished Death of Socrates with the old philosopher reaching for his cup of hemlock. Only when we pass the paintings Curry brought for the trustees' exhibit do Paul's eyes wander. We reach the door to the slide library, and he produces the keys again. One of them shifts quietly into place, and we enter the darkness.
Over here,
he says, pointing toward an aisle of shelves lined with dusty boxes. Each box contains a slide carousel. Behind another locked door, in a large room I've seen only once, rests much of the university's collection of art slides. Paul finds the set of boxes he's been searching for, then lifts one from the stack and places it on the shelf before him. A note taped to the side, written in a sloppy hand, says, "Maps, Rome." He takes the top off and carries the box to the small open space near the entrance. From another shelf, he produces a slide projector, which he plugs into a wall socket near the ground. Finally, with the flick of a switch, a blurry image appears on the opposite wall. Paul adjusts the focus until it sharpens into position.
Okay, I say, now tell me what we're doing here. What if Richard was right,
he says.
What if Vincent stole the diary from him 30 years ago?
He probably did. What does it matter now? Paul brings me up to speed.
Imagine you're in Vincent's position. Richard keeps telling you that the diary is the only way to understand the hypnerotomachia. You'd think he's just blowing smoke, just a college kid with an art history degree. Then someone else shows up, another scholar.
Paul says it with a certain respect. I gather he's referring to my father.
Suddenly, you're the odd man out. Both of them say the diary is the answer, but you've painted yourself into a corner. You've told Richard the diary is useless, that the portmaster was a charlatan. And more than anything, you hate being wrong. What do you do now?
Paul is trying to convince me of a possibility I've never had trouble accepting, that Vincent Taft is a thief.
I get it, I say. Go on. So you somehow steal the diary, but you can't make anything of it, because you've been looking at the hypnerotomachia all wrong. Without the ciphered messages from Francesco, you don't know what to do with the diary. What then?
I don't know.
You're not going to throw it away, he says, ignoring me, just because you don't understand it.
I nod my agreement.
So you keep it. Somewhere safe, maybe the lockbox in your office.
Or in your house.
Right. Then, years later, this kid comes along, and he and his friends start making progress on the hypnerotomachia. More than you expected. In fact, more than you made in your prime. He starts finding the messages from Francesco.
You start thinking the diary might be useful after all.
Exactly.
And you don't tell the kid about it, because then he'd know you stole it.
But, Paul continues, arriving at his point, say one day someone found it.
Bill. Paul nods.
He was always in Vincent's office, at Vincent's house, helping with all the little projects Vincent made him do. And he knew what the diary meant. If he'd found it, he wouldn't have just put it back.
He would have brought it to you.
Right. And we turned around and showed it to Richard. Then Richard confronted Vincent at the lecture.
I'm skeptical. But wouldn't Taft have realized it was gone before that?
Of course. He had to know Bill took it. But what do you think his reaction was when he realized Richard knew about it, too? The first thing on his mind would have been to go find Bill.
Now I understand. You think he went to Stein's office after the lecture?
Was Vincent at the reception?
I take it as a rhetorical question, until I remember Paul wasn't there. He'd already left to find Stein. Not that I saw.
There's a hallway connecting Dickinson and the auditorium, he says. Vincent didn't even have to leave the building to get there.
Paul lets it sink in. The possibility drifts through my thoughts clumsily, tethered to 1,000 other details.
You really think Taft killed him?
I ask. A strange silhouette forms from the shadows of the room. Epp Lang burying a dog beneath a tree. Paul stares at the black contours projected on the wall.
I think he's capable of it.
Out of anger?
I don't know.
But he already seems to have been through all the scenarios in his mind.
Listen, he says. When I was waiting for Bill at the Institute, I started reading the diary more carefully,
looking for every mention of Francesco.
He flips it open, and inside the front cover is a page of notes he's made on Institute stationery.
I found the entry where the portmaster records the set of directions the thief copied from Francesco's papers. Genovese says they were written on an empty scrap of paper and must have formed some kind of nautical route, something about the path Francesco's ship took. The portmaster tried to figure out where the cargo must have come from by working backward from Genoa.
When Paul unfolds the stationery, I can see a pattern of arrows drawn near a compass.
These are the directions. They're in Latin. They say, 4 south, 10 east, 2 north, 6 west. Then they say, De Stadio.
What's De Stadio? Paul smiles.
I think that's the key. The portmaster took it to his cousin, who told him De Stadio was the scale that went with the directions. It can be translated of stadia, meaning the directions are measured in stadia.
I don't get it.
The stadium is a unit of measurement from the ancient world based on the length of a foot race in the Greek Olympics. That's where we get our modern word. About 600 feet is one stadium, so there are between 8 and 10 stadia in a mile.
So 4 south means 4 stadia south.
Then 10 east, 2 north, and 6 west. It's all 4 directions. Does it remind you of something?
It does. In his final riddle, Colonna referred to what he called a rule of 4. A device that would lead readers to his secret crypt. But we gave up on finding it when the text itself failed to produce anything remotely geographical.
You think that's it? Those 4 directions?
Paul nods.
But the portmaster was looking for something on a much bigger scale, a voyage of hundreds and hundreds of miles. If Francesco's directions are in stadia, then the ship couldn't have originated in France or the Netherlands. It must have started its trip about 0.5 mile southeast of Genoa. The portmaster knew that couldn't be right.
I can see Paul's giddiness, thinking he's done the portmaster one better. You're saying the directions were meant for something else. He hardly pauses.
De stadio doesn't have to mean of stadia. De stadio could also mean from.
He looks at me expectantly, but the beauty of this new translation is lost on me.
Maybe the measurements aren't just of stadia, or measured in those units, he says. Maybe they're also taken from a stadium. A stadium could be the starting point. De stadio could have a double meaning. You follow the directions from a physical stadium building in stadia units.
The map of Rome projected on the wall is coming into focus. The city is littered with ancient arenas. Colonna would have known it better than any city in the world.
It solves the scale problem the portmaster had, Paul continues. You can't measure the distance between countries in a few stadia, but you can measure the distance across a city that way. Pliny says the circumference of the Roman walls in A.D. 75 was about 13 miles. The entire city was maybe 25 or 30 stadia across.
You think that'll lead us to the crypt? I ask.
Francesco talks about building where no one can see. He doesn't want anyone to know what's inside. This may be the only way to find the location.
Months of speculation return to me. We spent many nights wondering why Colonna would build his crypt out in the Roman forests, hidden from his family and friends, but Paul and I never agreed about our conclusions.
What if the crypt is more than we thought, he says. What if the location is the secret?
Then what's inside it, I say, reviving the question. Paul's demeanor changes to frustration.
I don't know, Tom. I still haven't figured it out.
I'm just saying, don't you think Colonna would have
told us what was in the crypt? Of course. But the entire second half of the book depends on the last cipher, and I can't solve it. not alone. So this diary is it, okay?
I back off.
So all we have to do, Paul goes on, is look at a few of these maps. We start at the major stadium areas, the Colosseum, the Circus Maximus, and so on, and move 4 stadia south, 10 east, 2 north, and 6 west. If any of those locations is in what would have been a forest in Colonna's time, we mark it.
Let's look, I say.
Paul presses the advance button, shifting through a series of maps made in the 15th and 16th centuries. They have the quality of architectural caricatures, buildings drawn out of proportion with their surroundings, crowded up against each other until the spaces in between are impossible to judge. How are we going to measure distance on those, I ask. He answers me by pumping the hand control several more times. After 3 or 4 more Renaissance maps, a modern one appears. The city looks more like the one I remember from travel books my father gave me before our trip to the Vatican. The Aurelian Wall on the north, east, and south, and the Tiber River on the west create the profile of an old woman's head facing the rest of Italy. The Church of San Lorenzo, where Colonna had the 2 men killed, hovers like a fly just beyond the arch of the old woman's nose.
This one has the right scale on it, Paul says, pointing to the measurements in the upper left corner.
8 stadia are marked along a single line, labeled Ancient Roman Mile. He walks toward the image on the wall and places his hand beside the scale. From the base of his palm to the tip of his middle finger, he covers the full 8 stadia.
Let's start with the Colosseum.
He kneels on the floor and places his hand near a dark oval in the middle of the map, near the old woman's cheek.
4 south, he says, moving a palm length down, and 10 east.
He moves 1 full hand length across, then adds 1/2 an index finger.
Then 2 north and 6 west.
When he finishes, he's pointing to a spot labeled M. Celius on the map.
You think that's where it is?
Not there, he says, deflated.
Pointing to a dark circle on the map just southwest of his finishing point, he says,
right over here is a church, San Stefano Rotondo.
He shifts his finger northeast.
This is another one, Santi Quattro Coronati. And here,
he moves the finger southeast,
is St. John Lateran, where the popes lived until the 14th century. If Francesco had built his crypt here, he would have done it within a 1/4 mile of 3 different churches, no way.
He begins again.
The Circus Flaminius, he says. This map is old. I think Gatti placed it closer to here.
He moves his finger closer to the river, then repeats the directions.
Good or bad, I say, staring at the location, somewhere atop the Palatine Hill.
He frowns.
Bad. This is almost right in the middle of San Teodoro.
Another church?
He nods. You're sure Colonna wouldn't have built it near a church?
He looks at me as if I've forgotten the cardinal rule.
Every message says he's terrified of being caught by the zealots, the men of God. How do you interpret that?
Losing patience, he tries 2 other possibilities. The Circus of Hadrian and the old Circus of Nero, over which the Vatican was built. But in both cases, the rectangle of 22 stadia lands him almost in the middle of the Tiber River.
There's a stadium in every corner of this map, I tell him. Why don't we think about where the crypt could be, then work backward to see if there's a stadium near it?
He mulls it over.
I'd have to check some of my other atlases at Ivy.
We can come back here tomorrow. Paul, whose supply of optimism is thinning, eyes the map a moment longer, then nods. Colonna has beat him again. Even the spying portmaster was outwitted.
What now? I ask.
He buttons his coat, turning off the projector.
I want to check Bill's desk in the library downstairs.
He returns the slide machine to its shelf, trying to leave everything where he found it.
Why? To see if anything else from the diary is there. Richard insists there was a blueprint folded inside it.
He opens the door and holds it for me, checking the room before locking it up.
You have a key for the library? He shakes his head.
Bill told me the punch code for the stairwell.
We return into the darkness of the hallway, where Paul leads me down the corridor. Orange security lights wink in the darkness, like airplanes crossing at night. We come to a door leading to a stairwell. Below the knob is a box with 5 numbered buttons. Paul thinks for a second, then begins to punch a short sequence. As the knob unlocks in his hand, both of us freeze. In the silence, we can hear something shuffling. Chapter 14.
Go,
I mouth, nudging Paul toward the library door. A plate of security glass forms a small window in the panel, and we peek through it into the darkness of the room. A shadow is shifting across the top of one of the private tables. The beam of a flashlight hovers across its surface. I can make out a hand reaching into one of the drawers.
That's Bill's desk, Paul whispers.
His voice carries in the stairwell. The path of the flashlight freezes, then moves in our direction. I push Paul down below the window.
Who is that? I ask. I couldn't see.
We wait, listening for footsteps. When we hear them moving away into the distance, I peek into the room again. It's empty. Paul pushes the door forward. The entire area is sunk in the long shadows of bookshelves. Moonlight presses at the sheet glass windows to the north. The drawers of Stein's desk are still open.
Is there another exit?
I whisper as we approach. Paul nods and points past a series of ceiling-high shelves. Suddenly, there are footsteps again, shuffling in the direction of the exit, followed by a click. The door latches gently into place. I move toward the sound.
What are you doing?
Paul whispers. He signals me back to him by the desk. I peer out the security glass into the far stairwell, but I can make out nothing. Paul is already rummaging through Stein's papers, splaying his penlight over a clutter of notes and letters. He points at a locked drawer that's been pried open. The files in it have been pulled out and scattered over the desk. Edges of paper curl up like untended grass. There seems to be a folder for every professor in the history department. Recommendation, Chairman Worthington. Recommendations A through M, Baum, Carter, Godfrey, Lee. Recommendations N through Z, Newman, Rossini, Sackler, Worthington, Pre-Chair. Recommendations Other Departments, Connor, Delfossi, Lutke, Mason, Quinn. Old Correspondence, Hargrave/Williams, Oxford. Old Correspondence, Appleton, Harvard. It means nothing to me, but Paul is fixed on them. What's wrong? I ask. Paul runs his flashlight across the desktop. Why does he need all these recommendations? Two other files lie open. One is titled Recommendation/Correspondence, Taft. The other is Leverage/Leeds. Taft's letter has been pushed into a corner, brushed aside. Paul rolls his shirt cuff over his fingers and yanks the paper into view.
William Stein is a competent young man. He has worked under me for 5 years and has mainly been useful in matters administrative and clerical. I'm confident that he'll do a similar job wherever he goes.
God, Paul whispers. Vincent screwed him.
He reads it again.
Bill sounds like a secretary.
When Paul unfolds the dog-eared corner of the page, the date is from last month. He picks it up, revealing a handwritten postscript.
Bill, I'm writing this for you in spite of everything. You deserve less, Vincent.
You bastard, Paul whispers. Bill was trying to get away from you.
He pans the flashlight over the Leverage/Leeds folder. A series of Stein's letter drafts lie on top, worked over in several pens. Lines have been inserted and removed until the text is difficult to follow. As Paul reads them, I can see the penlight begin to quiver in his hand.
Don Hargrave, begins the first letter. I am pleased to inform you that my research on the Hypnerata machia polyphili is complete, crossed out, nears completion. My results will be available by the end of April, if not sooner. I assure you they are worth the wait. As I have heard nothing from you and Master Williams since my letter of 17 January, please confirm that the professorship, crossed out, position we discussed remains available. My heart is with Oxford, but I may not be able to fend off other universities once my paper is published and I'm faced with new offers.
Paul flips to the following page. I can hear him breathing now.
Chairman Appleton, I write to you with good news. My work on the Hypnerata machia draws successfully to a close. As promised, crossed out, the results will cast a shadow over everything else in Renaissance historical studies, or any historical studies, this year or next. Before I publish my results, I want to confirm that the assistant professorship is still available. My heart is with Harvard, but I may not be able to fend off other temptations once my paper is published and I'm faced with new offers.
Paul reads it a second time, then a third.
He was gonna try to take it from me, he whispers faintly, stepping away from his desk to lean back on the wall. How is that possible? Maybe he thought no one would believe it was undergraduate work.
I refocus on the letter. When did he offer to type up your thesis?
Sometime last month.
He's been meaning to take it for that long? Paul glares at me and moves his hand across the desk.
Obviously, he's been writing these people since January.
When the letters settle on the desktop, a final sheet of correspondence peeks out from behind the Oxford and Harvard letters. When Paul sees the corner of the stationery, he pulls it out.
Richard, it begins, I hope this letter finds you well. Perhaps you've had better luck in Italy than you had in New York. If not, then we both know the situation you're in. We also both know Vincent. I think it's fair to say he has plans of his own for anything that comes of this. I therefore have a proposition for you. There's more than enough here to suit both of us, and I've come up with a division of labor I think you'll find fair. Please contact me soon to discuss. Leave me your phone numbers in Florence and Rome as well. The mail over there is unreliable, and I'd prefer to straighten this out ASAP. B.
The reply, in a different pen and a different hand, has been written on the bottom of the original letter and sent back. There are two telephone numbers, one preceded by the letter F, the other by an R. A final note is jotted afterward.
As requested, call after business hours my time. What about Paul?
Richard. Paul is speechless. He rifles through the papers again, but there's nothing else. When I try to console him, he motions me off. We should tell the dean, I say finally.
Tell him what, that we were going through Bill's stuff?
Suddenly, a bright reflection curves along the opposite wall, followed by colored lights flashing through the sheet glass windows. A police car has arrived in the front courtyard of the museum, siren mute. Two officers emerge. The red and blue lights go dead just as a second squad car arrives and two more officers follow.
Someone must have told them we were here, I say.
The note from Curry shakes in Paul's hand. He's standing in place, watching the dark forms hurry toward the main entrance.
Come on!
I yank him toward the bookshelves by the rear exit. Just then, the front door to the library opens, and the beam of a flashlight lances across the room. We duck into a corner. Both officers enter the room.
Over there,
the first officer says, gesturing in our direction. I grab the knob and press the back door open. Paul ducks into the hallway as the first policeman nears. On my haunches, I clamber out and regain my feet. We slide with our backs to the wall, and Paul leads us to the stairs, racing toward the ground floor. When we return to the open space of the main hall, I can see a flashlight skirting a nearby wall.
Downstairs, Paul says. There's a service elevator.
We enter the Asian wing of the museum. Sculptures and vases sit behind ghostly walls of glass. Chinese scrolls lie unraveled and mounted beside tomb figures in display cabinets. The room is a murky shade of green.
This way,
Paul urges as the footsteps come closer. He leads me around a corner, back into a dead end, where the only exit is the large pair of metal doors to the service elevator. Voices grow louder. I can make out two policemen standing at the foot of the stairs, trying to find their way around in the dark. Suddenly, the entire floor is illuminated.
"We got lights," comes the voice of a third.
Paul forces his key into the slot on the wall. When the elevator doors part, he pulls me in. A barrage of footsteps follows, moving in our direction.
"Come on! Come on!"
The doors remain open. For a second, I think they've cut the power to the elevator. Then, just as the first officer turns the corner, the metal walls slide shut. A hand beats against the doors when the officer catches up, but the sound fades as the cabin begins to move.
"Where are we going?" I ask.
"Out the loading docks," Paul says, trying to catch his breath. We exit into a holding area of some kind, and Paul forces open the door leading into a huge, cold room. I wait for my eyes to adjust. The garage doors of the loading bays loom before us. The wind outside is so close it's making the metal panels tremble. I imagine footsteps racing downstairs in our direction, but nothing is audible through the thick door. Paul rushes over to a switch on the wall. When he turns the knob, an engine stirs, and the retractable loading door begins to budge.
"That's enough,"
I say, once the opening is big enough to admit both of us on our backs. But Paul shakes his head, and the door continues to rise.
"What are you doing?"
The gap between the floor and the bottom of the door increases until it brings the entire vista of South Campus into view. For a second, I'm stopped short by how beautiful it is, how empty. Suddenly, Paul turns the motor knob in the opposite direction, and the door starts to roll shut.
"Go!"
he cries. He darts from the wall toward the open bay, and I fumble, trying to get on my back. Paul's already in front of me. He rolls beneath the door, then pulls me out just before the metal connects with the ground. I stand up, trying to catch my breath. When I begin moving in the direction of Dodd, Paul jerks me back.
"They'll see us from upstairs."
He points to the windows on the west side of the building. After scanning the path to our east, he says,
"This way."
"Are you okay?" I ask, following. He bobs his head and we trudge into the night, away from our quad and out of their sightlines. I can feel the wind beneath my coat collar, cooling the sweat on my neck. When I look back, Dodd and Brown Hall are almost purely dark, as is every dormitory in the distance. Night has reached all corners of campus. Only the windows at the art museum are shot with light. We continue east through Prospect Gardens, a botanical wonderland in the heart of campus. The tiny spring plantings are dashed with white, almost invisible underfoot, but the American beech and the cedar of Lebanon stand like guardian angels above them, arms outstretched to shoulder the snow. A police car patrols one of the side streets, and we pick up our pace.
My thoughts are jumpy, my mind working to understand what we've seen. Maybe it was Taft we saw at Stein's desk, rifling through his papers, erasing any connection between them. Maybe he called the police on us.
I look over at Paul, wondering if the same thought has crossed his mind, but his expression is blank. In the distance, the new music department shows signs of life.
"We can go in there for a while," I suggest.
"Where?"
"The practice rooms in the basement, until we're clear."
Stray notes float in the air as we near. Night owl musicians come to Woolworth to rehearse in private. Down toward Prospect, another campus police car skids by, splashing slush and rock salt onto the curb. I force myself to walk faster. Construction on Woolworth has only recently finished, and the building that emerged from the scaffolding is a curious thing, fortress-like from the outside, but glassy and fragile-looking from within. Its atrium curves like a river through the music library and classrooms on the ground floor, rising 3 stories to skylights above. The wind howls jealously around it. Paul unlocks the entrance to the building with his ID card, holding the door as I pass through.
"Which way?" he asks.
I lead him to the nearest staircase. Gil and I have been here 2 times since the building was opened, both times after drinks on a slow Saturday night. His father's 2nd wife insisted that Gil learn to play something by Duke Ellington, the same way my father insisted that I learn something by Arcangelo Corelli, and between us we have 8 years of lessons and almost nothing to show for it. Thumping our bottles on top of an old baby grand, Gil would bungle A-Train, I'd butcher La Folia, and we'd pretend to keep a beat that neither of us had ever learned. Paul and I pad down the basement hallway to find that only 1 piano is still at work. Someone in a distant practice room is playing Rhapsody in Blue. We slip into a small, soundproof studio, and Paul edges behind the upright piano, taking a seat on the stool. He looks at the keys of the piano, mysterious as computer keys to him, and doesn't touch them. The overhead light sputters for a second, then goes dead. It's just as well.
"I can't believe it," he says finally, taking a deep breath.
"Why would they do it?" I ask. Paul runs his index finger across a key, scratching at the ebony. When he seems not to hear the question, I repeat myself.
"What do you want me to say, Tom?"
"Maybe this is why Stein wanted to help in the first place."
"When?" "Tonight with the diary?"
"Months ago."
"You mean when you stopped working on the hypnerotomachia?"
The chronology is a jab, a reminder that Stein's involvement traces ultimately back to me.
"You think this is my fault?"
"No," Paul says quietly. "Of course not." But the accusation hangs in the air. The map of Rome, like the diary, has reminded me of what I left behind, how much progress we made before I left, how much I enjoyed it. I look at my hands curled up in my lap. It was my father who said I had lazy hands. 5 years of lessons hadn't produced a single presentable Corelli sonata. That's when he started pushing basketball instead.
"The strong take from the weak, Thomas, but the smart take from the strong."
"What about the note to Curry?" I say, fixing on the back of the piano. The wood is unvarnished and raw along the entire side where the upright is supposed to face a wall. It strikes me as a strange economy, like a professor who doesn't brush the back of his hair because he can't see it in the mirror. My father used to do that. It was a defect of perspective, I always thought, the mistake of someone who could only see the world 1 way. His students must have noticed it as often as I did, every time he turned his back on them.
"Richard would never try to take something from me," Paul says, biting at a nail. "We must have missed something."
A hush settles in. The practice room is warm, and when we're both quiet, there's no sound at all besides an occasional hum from down the hall, where Gershwin has been replaced by a Beethoven sonata that rumbles in the distance. It reminds me of sitting through summer storms as a child. The power is out, the house is quiet, and nothing can be heard besides the roll of far-off thunder. My mother is reading to me by candlelight, Bartholomew Cubbins or an illustrated Sherlock Holmes, and the only thing on my mind is how the best stories always seem to be about men in funny hats.